In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska.
As heavy snowfall continues in the interior of Alaska, please exercise caution. Never separate from your party, even if you're alone.
Jenny Brown gets a valuable lesson on wilderness survival from the Bureau of Land Management, and Dan Flodine learns where his tax dollars went.
And I look up at one of the Coast Guard guys who's looking at me, and I'm just like, do I have to pay for this? He said, do you pay taxes? And I said, yeah. He's like, this is your free ride.
Pay your taxes if you want to live. Up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, I'm Rob Prince. You've certainly heard the old adage that the only two things that are inevitable in this life are death and taxes. Well, up in Alaska, those two concepts are related by more than just their inevitability. Paying your taxes can actually help postpone your death, as Dan Flodine found out. He shared this story at our November 2023 live event in Fairbanks.
My story takes place exactly 32 years ago from tomorrow, and I was 20 years old at the time. And I discovered as a teenager, commercial fishing might be a lot of fun. And I had an opportunity, and I was a deckhand in Bristol Bay for 3 years. I worked on a seiner in Kodiak for 2 years. Some days my crew share was $2,000. I'm like, if I'm making two, my boss is making like 20. So I saved all my money, and I bought into commercial fishing to get on the ownership side. And the only place that I could find a way in was in Prince William Sound. And so I started my business, and I commercial fished in the summer of 1991, running my own boat. It was a very challenging year. It was a fishery I didn't know, and I had to take my semester off at UAF. I was a business student, and I fished the Silver Run through September, try and make ends meet. I had a lot of financial obligations. I got a huge loan, and I came back in November with my parents' business partner's name is Bob, and he was just going to go for a ride with me from Valdez to Seward, where we put the boat in dry dock for the winter till next summer. And so it's a two-day trip. My boat was a 38-foot fiberglass boat called the Easy Rider, and I still never watched the movie. And so we headed out, and first I went to the fuel dock, and I took on 180 gallons of diesel. They had to kick all the snow off the pumps, and the first day we headed out, the plan was to stop at Naked Island, which is kind of in the middle of Prince William Sound. And so, uneventful, the boat only goes about 7.5 knots. Again, it's a 38-foot fiberglass boat. The next day, we're going from Naked Island to Seward. And so we head out, and I see the barometer start to drop. And as you know, in weather forecasts, interior, south central, they're not always right. But the barometer tells you the truth. And by the time I got out of Prince William Sound, heading toward Resurrection Bay in Seward, the wind kicked up to 45, and the seas built to 14 feet with a chop on the top. It was uncomfortable. I'm kind of white-knuckling. I could see the entrance to Resurrection Bay. I chose to go between Hive Island and Rugged Island. There's several choices coming from the west traveling east, or east traveling west. Right when I got between Hive Island and Rugged Island, the engine dies. So now I'm going 5.5 knots sideways in the swell, 14-foot seas, and we're heading toward this cliff face of Rugged Island. And I told Bob, we're in trouble. I said, get your survival suit on. You know, mayday, mayday, mayday. This is the Easy Rider, Easy Rider, Easy Rider. There's a cadence you go through, your location. The Coast Guard responded. Bob's getting the survival suit on. And I'm like, all right, we're heading right for this cliff face. And I got my survival suit on. And so I think I must have got water. It must have flooded the Raycor fuel filters and killed the engine. Well, our engine room is down below the waterline, and you got to crawl back like 12 feet. And I'm heading to this cliff face. It's really dark, but I can see this huge, like, you can just see the shadow darker of the cliff face. And I'm like, all right, I'm not going to go crawl back below the waterline and get stuck. And I'm like, that would be a good way to be by Dan. And the anchor, all boats have an anchor, but you have to undo two screws to get the casing off to break the chain, because the hydraulic motor doesn't work if the engine doesn't work. So even if I hadn't been able to remove the outer casing, break the chain, kick the anchor overboard, it was 134 feet deep, two waves from the cliff face. So if you know any of the physics, if you have an anchor, you know, straight down, you're not going to have any bite, especially in 45-mile-an-hour winds, 14-foot seas. So it just wouldn't have worked. And so we have rigging on the boat, we have gear on the boat, and I said, Bob, we need to go off the bow. And I was Of course, in between this on the radio, relaying what's going on. I couldn't get the engine going. I tried a couple times anyway, but it was completely dead. So about two waves before the boat hits this cliff face, we jump off the bow. And I turn the anchor light on so I can try and watch it, because it's you know, this is about 5 p.m., November 19th, and it's dark. And in the midst of the wind and the waves, I heard this huge crack. And that's when the boat hit the cliff face, and with under 5 minutes, it sank. And so, by the way, I'm 20. I have one duffel bag to my name, and everything I own just went down with the boat. So, and you think, all right, we're in the water. Every wave was like a 2x4 hit me in the back of the head because there's a chop on the top. And we're swimming to stay off this cliff face. We don't want to have the same fate as the boat. And so we're swimming for hours. And I noticed Bob, you know, we were never right next to each other. We were about 50 to 80 feet apart. And it's really noisy with the wind. So I'm yelling things and we're using kind of hand signals or thumbs up. And Bob had put one of the older survival suits on, which had, it was an Imperial brand, it has a black ring, but he couldn't find the inflation tube between all the waves. So he had to time his breathing for over 5 hours. Every wave he was submerged. And for me, it was better than that from the breathing point, but every wave I was getting the crap beat out of my head. But for hours we swam to stay off this cliff face. And finally the state ferry Testamina responds. And it's just under 300 feet long. It's 60 feet wide. It's much taller than the stands outside. It's a big boat. So they make these passes, and I have a strobe. I had a stern survival suit on, which has a built-in flotation behind my head. I was able to inflate it, so I was even more buoyant. And I had a strobe flashing. Meanwhile, the Testamina keeps going back and forth, and they launch four life rafts, and they make an explosion noise and because of the inflating, and they're really big because it's the ferry. And so what do you think happens when you explode a huge life raft and it's blowing 45? They start blowing away in cartwheels at 45 miles an hour. Not helpful. So then at one point, they're coming by really close to me, and I can see them. And it's, if you're like getting your Fred Meyer groceries and you look back at the candy stand, it's probably like 10 feet from me. And it's going by me, and I feel this huge wall of water push against me. It's the ferry pushing through the water, and it's just pushing me back. And then when I get toward the stern, guess what happens? It starts sucking me down. And I think I did the most panicked, terrified dog paddle I've ever done. Because I mean, it's like going down the drain. I was getting pulled under the water. And the engineer came to the hospital afterwards from the ferry and Seward, and he said, "We saw your strobe at the top of one of the waves. We turned our rudder and we cut our engines." So I don't know what would have happened if the engines had been engaged when they drifted past me, but it would have been probably even more scary. And the other thing is I also got, when they went by me 10 feet away, I could see people at the rail and I'm like, help me. I thought they'd throw me a line. I thought they would, you know, there's a life ring on every boat. And they told me they couldn't stop or they would have blown up against the cliff face. So, but that's why they didn't stop and, you know, pick us up. So anyway, it was, and the nurse from the ferry sent me a really nice card about 2 or 3 weeks after this adventure. And she said there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. They wanted to rescue us. And so anyway, the tide starts taking us out, and the Testamina is shining these huge lights so I can see a little bit more. And the tide starts taking us kind of back out to sea. And if you've been around Resurrection Bay, there's an island called Barwell Island. It's kind of right outside. And I told Bob, I can see a ledge. I'm going to swim for this ledge. And I'm yelling at him. Of course, it's still windy and it's just hard to hear. He gives me like a thumbs up, and I swim for this ledge. What I don't see is all the boulders right before the ledge in between the 14-foot seas. And when I get close, I start getting pinballed around. And that's when my left shoulder dislocated, came in and out. And I'm like, is like this the end? I'm getting just pinballed around and beat up. And somehow I made it through. At some point, I got through the rocks, and I'm at this ledge now where I've got to scale up to get out of the water. I scramble up. A wave crashes and drops me back in the water. I try it again. Another wave hits me and drops me back in the water. And I'm like, how am I going to get out of this now? And I can't explain it. but the waves just stopped. They just stopped. So like, all right, is the physics of the Testamina, did it break up the wave pattern? I don't know. So I scrambled up, and then the waves started crashing in again. I look up and I see, I mean, the sky is stormy, but it's dark except there's a helicopter, and it's a Coast Guard helicopter. To me, it looked like, all right, there's an angel coming. It's this huge, bright thing with all these lights on. And it was like, all right, it's going to get better. And they pick up Bob first. He's about 150 yards offshore, kind of kept going out with the tide. And I saw them bring the basket down, the rescue swimmer. And then they come over to me. And they're hovering offshore. And I picked a great ledge because behind me, the cliff goes back out above me. So they actually can't hover over me. So they send the rescue swimmer in after a few minutes, and he's like, I need your help. I'm like, uh-oh. He's like, we got to go back in the water. And he's like, I've studied these rocks. I've got flippers on. I'm going to be pulling on this pillow behind your head, and you need to do everything you can to help me. And so out we go, and I'm on my back trying to kick and paddle, and he was much better at it than when I came in. We didn't bash any rocks, and we get out to the rescue basket. I don't know if you've been under a helicopter, but it's got to be blown down on us about 200 miles an hour. It's intense. There's still huge waves. I get in the basket, and I'm going up, and this intense wind is hitting me. And I get up to the helicopter bay, and they pull me in, and there's three Coast Guardsmen, and I don't know if you've ever taken your clothes off with help as an adult, but I had three full-grown men cut my clothes off. They assume you're hypothermic and you're about to die, I think. And they stick me in this bag I call it the thermonuclear bag. I don't know what it is. It's not a regular sleeping bag. It's huge, thick cloths. It was probably wicking or whatever. And they put me in this bag. I try to tell them, okay, and I look across the bay and there's Bob. It's super noisy. He's in another bag just like the one I'm in. And I look up at one of the Coast Guard guys who's looking at me, and I'm just like, do I have to pay for this? And he said, do you pay taxes? And I said, yeah. He's like, this is your free ride. So we land in Seward. By the way, I'm like, have no clothes now. It's all been cut off me. But I'm like, I can walk. And like, no. I said, I can walk. Nope, they would not let me walk. They had me on a backboard, on a gurney, and they're rolling me out the back of the helicopter, and I'm looking at the guy who's about to carry the upper part. I mean, he's probably 160 pounds. At the time, I was about 230. I was a gym rat at UAF, and he gets to my head, and when it comes off the helicopter, you hear, ugh! And I drop about 10 inches, maybe a foot, and I'm like, oh my God, he's just going to drop me. He managed to not drop me. They got the wheels down. Into the ambulance we go, and then we get to the hospital, and there must be 10, 12 hospital folks. Of course, they assume you're hypothermic too. And then he's like, we need to get the backboard out from under you. I'm like, okay. He's like, you need to, you know, prop yourself up. So I spread my legs. I do like the reverse crab walk, prop myself up for all to see. And I see all the people in there looking at me and the family jewels. And I'm like, and they're pulling out the backboard. And I'm like, just like, it's a boy. They started laughing, and it kind of broke the mood. And, you know, I'm 20, and there's no smartphones. There's no, texting. And my dad helped me, you know, get started in my business. And I call my dad, and I'm like, I'm alive. Bob's alive. The Easy Rider is not. And I said, does Rick still live close to here? So Rick was my dad's friend who he helped train with. They ran the Iditarod together, and longtime family friend. And he's like, yeah. I was like, I have no clothes. I said, can Rick come to the hospital and bring me some clothes? And I mean underwear too. So Rick, he came and he brought clothes and was able to leave. We were okay. Bob had to stay overnight because he had salt water in his lungs, and he had to time is breathing so long, but we were fine. And like the smart person I am, I bought another boat and I fished for 4 more years.
Dan Flodin, He shared that story at our November 2023 live event in Fairbanks. This is Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Pay Your Taxes If You Want to Live episode. I'm Rob Prince. In the winter of 2021, there was an epic storm around Christmas that we called the Ice Apocalypse up in Fairbanks. Feet of snow got covered with inches of ice and then more snow. It was an absolute nightmare. Our next storyteller managed to make that storm even more interesting by being way out in the middle of nowhere with her teenage son and dog team when the ice apocalypse hit. Her tax dollars came to save the day as well. Jenny Brown shared this story at our March 2023 live event in Fairbanks, and there's a couple of things I want to mention before we hear it. First of all, she mentions an InReach, MREs, and BLM. An InReach is a little satellite communication device that allows you to message people when you're out in the middle of nowhere, and also get rescued if you're in danger. MREs are meals ready to eat, self-contained packs of food designed for soldiers to eat when they're out in the field. And BLM is the Bureau of Land Management up in Alaska. Finally, you should know that Jenny was our audience storyteller at that March 2023 event, which means she put her name in a hat and got picked to tell her story live on stage with no notice and no coaching in front of around 900 people, which is really incredible to me, and she did a wonderful job. Here's Jenny.
Christmas of 2021. Epic snowstorm, right? So we were in the White Mountains, training sled dogs. My son ran the junior Iditarod last year, and so we were out there. Thank you, Sawyer. So we were out doing some training runs, and we knew the epic storm was coming, and it was forecasted for Sunday evening. So we said, all right, we got this. We are going out on Thursday. We're going to go out about 24 miles to a cabin. We're going to stay the night, rest the dogs. We'll run another 10 to 15 miles the next day to a farther cabin. We'll rest overnight till Christmas. And then we'll run the 45 miles out, give the dogs a really good run. We'll come back the day the storm's supposed to come, and we'll make it home just fine. We got a big old truck. We got dogs. No problem. We'll get home for the snowstorm. Yeah. Snowstorm came about 32 hours early. So we got the first 24 miles, beautiful, get to the cabin, great overnight trip, get the dogs geared up the next day, and we run the next 14 miles in to our wonderful favorite cabin out there. Again, a nice run. This one's a little harder. This one goes over a dome. If you're familiar with domes out here, they're like no trees, domed white, no landmarks, no nothing. This does become significant. And coming off of this dome, we go down the other side into a riverbank, and it's all nice, and we get out to the cabin. And, of course, we have our InReach, so we have communication. And I did manage ahead of time to decide maybe I'll, up my subscription so I have a few more free texts this time out. 104 texts in the end over 5 days. So glad I upped that one. So we get to the cabin, wake up Saturday morning. We're doing fine, texting friends in Fairbanks, and they're like, hey, the storm is hitting here. I'm like, it's beautiful here. It's not snowing yet in the mountains. So they're like, yeah, town is a mess. It's like a foot of snow already, and I'm out way out in the mountains. I'm going, okay, what's the best call here? Do we stay and get stuck in the mountains in the snow, or do we go to town and end up with a big truck, a trailer with snow machines somewhere stuck on the road? So we decided to stay in the mountains. That night, the snowstorm hits. So that morning, Sawyer takes off with the snow machine to break some trail. It's okay, 6-8 inches. He gets that done, gets back, and we decide, okay, this snow is hitting, and I really don't want to be 40 miles into the mountains. So we're going to take our chances that there's an open cabin that we can get to. One of the ways to run dogs, especially if you're concerned about weather, is just hook them to the front of the snow machine. So we got ourselves set up. We had 13 dogs, one snow machine, one dog sled. So dogs are hooked up to the snow machine, pulling the dog sled behind, and we're doing fine until we're not. Forgetting that dogs like to go uphill slowly, and snow machines have to go up hills quickly or they will get very, very stuck. So we hit the hill going back up to the dome with the dogs attached to the snow machine and bury the snow machine. So unhook the dogs, and I'm like, I'll take the dogs up to the top of the dome and you get the snow machine unstuck. So now I'm on top of the dome with the dog team, no trees, nothing to tie to. I can put a snow hook in. I maybe could put a snow hook in front of the dogs. Chances are that's not going to hold. So if I try to go back and help him, dogs are going to turn around and turn it. God knows what's going to happen there. Tangles, messes. So I'm standing on top of this dome in a snowstorm now, blowing snow sideways. And I can just see his headlight. Now it's dark. See, his headlight isn't moving. 15, 20 minutes. I'm going, okay, how long, what do I do? Like, all I can do is stand here. And then I see some lights. Pretty soon, here he comes, up to the top of the dome with the snow machine. I'm like, right on, you got it unstuck. And he's like, yeah, I buried it a couple times, but I couldn't get the sled. So the sled with the dog food and the gear is still down there on the bottom of the dome. So we're like, okay, what do I do? Well, there's this wonderful trick, if you've never tried it, of tying a rope to your snow machine and a rope to your sled, and you make a run for it with the snow machine, and it sort of catapults your sled behind you. So he goes back to do that. Here, snow machine for a while. Pretty soon he comes back. Where's the rope? I'm like, okay. So we're still getting this. I'm still standing up there in this dog sled. You know, dogs are bored. Like, we're standing in a snowstorm. And pretty soon he shows up. He managed to get the sled unstuck. He got up to the dome. Burned God knows how much gas at this point, right? So now it is 30 above, raining sideways. We are soaking wet. The dogs are soaking wet. Let's get out of this. So I'm running the dogs. We have a wonderful lead dog who is one of these. There's several different kinds of lead dogs, and one is who knows when they're not on the trail anymore, and they are like, whoop, we are going over there. We had one of those, and so she kept us where we were going. So I'm leading with this slow dog team. He's tootling behind me, and I'm thinking, we're going to run out of gas. So I'm going along, you know, super slogging along, just praying that the lights don't go out behind me. We get to the cabin. Snow is up to the cabin, wind blown. It looks like the moon with the cabin. And so we pull as many dogs in behind the cabin. There's this wonderful, like, there's actually almost like ground behind the cabin and then a big old windblown drift. So we get as many dogs into that area behind the cabin as we can. Now, we haven't eaten since we left the first cabin. So I'm like, so we get inside, take a few things, and what do we find? Like this massive, one of these big refill packets of Pez. And so of all the things in the world, we're sitting at this cabin, like we're just barely got a fire going. We're like, Pez, 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 Pez. Okay, we got a little bit of energy now. We can do this. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to thaw out. I'm going to start melting water for the dogs. We'll get that taken care of. You unload the sleds. I'm like, we got enough wood to stay warm for the night. We'll just let it freeze. We got 40 below bags, whatever. So he's like, heck no. Next thing I know, he's got like 10 trees. These cabins are in burns, so there's like lots of firewood. He gets some firewood in. We get the dogs settled in. We can only get 6 of them behind the cabin, so 7 of them are in the cabin with us all night long, which was fine. All things considered, never had any dog fights. And so next day, so we're still communicating, and people are like, can someone, you know, come out, maybe bring us some fuel, let us know what's going on? Oh, yeah, we're texting a friend in town. Carolyn's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to come out. I'm going to bring you guys some fuel. We're going to bring you some dog food. And she's like, I'll leave in a couple hours. And she sends a message back. Yeah, no, roads are shut down again. Okay. So we're settled in. We got tons of food, actually, tons of batteries. iPad never ran out. We read stories. You know, InReaches have incredible battery lives. 5 days, we were still at like 82%. Pretty impressive. And so we just keep getting this, like, oh, now the trails are so bad. Is someone going to be able to find the trails to get out to us? And we're starting to get a little worried, and I'm not sure that this snow machine's going to make it back to the trailhead. And I don't want to go to the trailhead till I know the roads are open. But thinking, then what? Now I'm at a dog truck. I don't have any heat. Not easy to eat. And so we stayed at the cabin. So we get to the point where we're now pushing 2 days longer than we planned to be out there. Now, you always travel with extra dog food. You know, and we're out of carbs, like we're eating MREs, have some protein. 15-year-olds without carbs, not always the greatest way to travel, especially when it's cold. But, you know, we got by. Like I said, we read lots of books, we played lots of games. And so everyone's kind of deciding, like, we can't help you. And I'm like, okay, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do, because I'm getting to the point now where I'm not worried, but I'm also like, what am I doing in the middle of the mountains in Alaska with 13 dogs and a kid? Like, who does that? Like, I don't know. So we finally, friends are like, hey, maybe we should reach out to BLM. So they get a hold of BLM, and the guys who take care of the trails out there, like, we'll go out and get them. And I'm like, I need dog food. I'd fed the last of my kibble, and I knew the dogs were going to need some energy to get out. So we're hanging out. We know they're coming. And, you know, it's mid-afternoon, and suddenly three big snow machines are, like, circling the cabin, putting in trails. We're like, right on, people, you know, fuel. And they're like, can you self-rescue if we give you some gas and some dog food? And we're like, yeah, we are fine. We just need some gas. So they come, they give us some gas, they give us some dog food. The two guys are like, we're going to go break trails and clear the parking lot. One ranger stayed with us with the snow machine. We get out to the parking lot, and we put the dogs on the snow machine. We tootled along. It was all good. We ended up being 1 gallon short on gas in the end. So we get to the parking lot, and here we're like the only truck. They've plowed out the parking lot, you know, so much snow. Actually, the guys had cleared it off, but there's still like a foot of snow on the highway, and this is like 30 Mile Elliott. So like past Fox on the parts of the road where like it's downhill, and then you do this one, and you go downhill and curve again. So BLM truck drives back with us. Thank goodness, because it's like a foot of snow. No semis have been through there. You can see where the road is, and you're just like, God, I hope a truck doesn't come around the next corner, because I have no idea where the road is. So got us back to Fox. Some wonderful friends met us there with Subway subs and cookies, and that was wonderful. So the moral of the story is, do not believe Facebook. Because here is what the BLM posted. Fairbanks District Office, recreation staff, and law enforcement rangers rescued two people and 14 sled dogs Monday evening, December 28th, in the White Mountains. The pair was already 2 days overdue, and weather conditions and exhaustion overwhelmed them. Okay. Rescue crews traveled more than 40 miles breaking trail to bring everyone and the dogs back to their vehicle. It was 24 miles. As heavy snowfall continues in the interior of Alaska, please exercise caution. Weather conditions can change rapidly. Equipment breakdowns and injuries can happen subtly. Never separate from your party, even if you're alone. Leave a travel plan with family or friends. Carry satellite communications device like an InReach. Thank you. That was our winter story.
Jenny Brown. She was the audience storyteller at our March 2023 live event in Fairbanks. Thanks so much for listening to this edition of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Pay Your Taxes If You Want to Live episode. Today's show was edited by me, Rob Prince. Story consultation by Lori Neufeld. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince.